to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits. With the UK having the worst rates in Europe, with already 60,000 people dead from the virus, the US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing president of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words. What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail, and as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves the vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, there are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members? But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have managed to flee Myanmar's northwestern state of Rakhine, where they repeatedly came under attack by the army and extremist Buddhists. Many of these refugees have come to Bangladesh over the past years. They have largely been camped in the southern district of Cox's Bazar, in overcrowded camps and in squalid conditions. This week, Bangladeshi authorities began moving Rohingya families from the camps near the Myanmar border without their consent. Bangladeshi police escort the refugees in buses to a port and then to this island. Bisanchar is their destination, a flood-prone island vulnerable to frequent cyclones. The remote island, the Bay of Bengal, emerged from the sea 20 years ago. The government of Bangladesh says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a small city there with mosques and red-roofed apartment blocks. It says the relocation will ease chronic overcrowding in camps at Cox's Bazar. but the refugees are unwilling to set foot on the remote island. There are many concerns about the conditions of the brand new settlement. For instance, distance from the mainland will make it very difficult to reach the refugees in emergencies. Meanwhile, hundreds of Rohingya who were sent to the island in April after being picked up at sea don't want to remain there. They have accused settlement guards of sexual assault. Bangladeshi authorities have not allowed the United Nations or rights groups to monitor their relocation.
It really raises the question, what is Bangladesh hiding if, you know, it has gone to such controversial length to decline offer, consistently offered by the United Nations agencies and UN itself, to do basic safety assessment of the island.
Rights groups want Bangladesh to halt the controversial move immediately. Rohingya Muslims are recognized by the UN as the world's worst persecuted minority group. In January, the United Nations highest court ordered Buddhist-majority Myanmar to prevent genocidal violence against its Rohingya Muslim minority and preserve evidence of past attacks. The International Court of Justice instructed the Asian country to respect the requirements of the 1948 Genocide Convention. The ICJ warned that nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims who are still in Myanmar are, quote, extremely vulnerable to violence at the hands of the military. But since the ICJ ruling, little has really changed. Human rights lawyers and activists said recently that Myanmar is continuing to commit genocide against Rohingya Muslims in violation of orders by the UN's top court. The ongoing crisis has left the international reputation of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, in tatters. Suu Kyi has defended the actions of the army and is unwilling to change her stance. Many rights groups and Rohingya activists have been demanding that she be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize. But so far, no meaningful action has been taken against her or the military.
Myanmar government has not really been put under any type of concerted pressure. You know, not by the United States, not by the European Union, not by British government, not certainly not by China or India or Japan.
Powerful states have considerable trade ties with Myanmar. They can easily use their economic leverage to force change in Myanmar's behavior, but they have chosen not to exert pressure on the country over the plight of the minority group.
It seems that even when Britain is down on its knees, it receives yet another kick in the teeth to make sure it won't get up again. The acclaimed and once respected British retail industry has seen two of its super heavyweights each receive a knockout blow to go with the rest of the nation, as both have collapsed dramatically within a day of each other. After 242 years of trading on the British High Street, what started off as a single store in London, well-known brand Debenhams has collapsed, putting at risk thousands of jobs and seeing 124 stores set to close for good, leaving a significant gap in the retail areas of the UK. Joining Debenhams and collapsing just a day before is the Arcadia Group, which owns the likes of Topshop, Burton, Dorothy Perkins and Evans, and will see 13,000 employees looking for work as Christmas approaches and a grim year comes to an end.
What all retailers need to understand, and some do it better than others, is that we need to have a reason to visit their stores. So I think as one of the lessons from this, although sadly, yeah, for the workforce at Arcadia, that might not apply so much, but for the industry, one of the lessons is that your store estate has got to be great. It's got to inspire, it's got to excite, and it's got to draw people in.
Between Debenhams and Arcadia, some 25,000 people will now join the unemployment figures that Britain is already suffering with. And alarmingly, with the majority of staff in the retail sector fairly unskilled, the prospects of a new job are far from a reality. Yet it's not just the retail sector that has suffered in Britain, with many other industries and big names collapsing in 2020, in part due to the COVID-19 virus, but also thanks to the disastrous handling of Brexit, which has seen many low-skilled workers flee the UK into richer European markets, leaving a gap in the labour market that's simply not being filled by the British. What now remains to be seen is whether the introduction of the upcoming vaccine created by Pfizer and BioNTech, which has just been approved by the British government, will come in time to save the other few remaining retail outlets that are hanging on by a thread as Brexit fast approaches, the COVID-19 pandemic peaks at its second wave, and the people and institutions of Britain are left on a knife edge as uncertainty reigns over the country. The next 36 hours will be crucial as Michel Barnier continues to work around the clock to put pressure on the British negotiating team to accept the terms and conditions being imposed by the EU, with Barnier in constant liaison with the 27 remaining EU states as to the progress of the talks, of which he holds the power of attorney on behalf of the EU. Yet in spite of multiple rounds of talks, Barnier remains far from optimistic that a deal can be done, and has warned the EU nations to face the very real prospect that Britain will leave the EU with no deal, leaving trade and commerce to continue under WTO rules, which will no doubt be far more painful for Britain than it will for the EU. Many EU nations have stated that they support Barnier and are insisting that he remain tough to the end, suggesting that under no circumstances should he compromise with the British to allow a deal to go through, unless it fully benefits the EU, with France leading the resistance and seeing backing from many other European superpowers.
Und ich wünsche Michel Barnier und gegebenenfalls auch Ursula von der Leyen viel Kraft und viel Geschick für die letzten Verhandlungsschritte. Wir brauchen aber auch kein Abkommen um jeden Preis, das haben wir deutlich gemacht. Wir wollen eins, aber wir werden sonst auch Maßnahmen ergreifen, die notwendig sind. Auf jeden Fall liegt ein Abkommen im Interesse aller.
So clear is the obvious lack of leadership displayed by the British negotiating team and the Conservative government of Boris Johnson, who so eagerly fought for Brexit, that the people of Britain are also waking up to the reality of the impact of Brexit, such as the collapse of the British retail industry, with many in Britain now showing signs that they're worried about what the future may hold for the tiny island nation. What is guaranteed is that Britain can no longer put all the blame on the COVID-19 virus for its disastrous year, and must now finally acknowledge that without the EU powerhouse to prop it up, Britain is weak and is falling faster than a house of cards.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Globally, more than 64 million cases of COVID-19 have been recorded, with nearly 1.5 million deaths. The World Health Organization's Director of Emergencies, Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking from Geneva, Switzerland during the first dialogue, said even with vaccines on the horizon, we're still in a very, very dangerous and difficult situation. He explained that some countries, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, are still experiencing major virus transmission. Although the situation in other regions may be stable, some of the countries still battle continued or returning transmission. He stressed, "We will be able to add vaccines to the current control measures, but let me be clear, vaccines or vaccination do not equal zero COVID." He added, "We must add vaccines to the existing parcel of measures that we have in place." As the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has remarked, the pandemic has been the greatest challenge to the global community since the organization was founded 75 years ago. But according to David Beasley, Executive Director of the World Food Programme, WFP, it has also sparked international action that includes recovery plans and economic stimulus packages. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers at news.un.org under the heading, UN Says Right Decisions on COVID-19 Now Will Secure a Life of Dignity for All. Please stay with us for more. Addressing the second and final day of the United Nations General Assembly's special session devoted to the coronavirus crisis, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed said, "Critical decisions made now to address the COVID-19 pandemic would lead to a life of dignity for all people." The head of the United Nations agencies, along with scientists and other stakeholders, held interactive dialogues focused on the health and humanitarian response, the road to vaccines, and addressing the socio-economic impact of the crisis on Friday, 4th of December. UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed outlined United Nations support for countries going forward, including mobilizing the $28 billion needed to secure vaccines for all, regardless of wealth and location, and assisting authorities everywhere to operationalize inclusive recovery plans. She said, "This session comes at a critical moment. If we make the right decisions now, we can meet the humanitarian needs, reset the development pathways, accelerate implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals, and secure a life of dignity and opportunity for all on a safe and healthy planet." UN General Assembly President Volkan Bozkir said in his opening address, "We cannot neglect our duties to the people we serve at this time of crisis, when it is even more important. COVID-19 has affected the entire planet and, by extension, every area of the United Nations work. Although the pandemic is a global health crisis, impacts have varied across countries, as have responses to the crisis." According to the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, who delivered a speech from its headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, while many countries have been able to prevent or contain the virus through proven public health measures, this is not a fluke of geography or demography. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said these nations have proved the efficacy of science, solidarity, and sacrifice, paraphrasing a motto he has used throughout the pandemic. Ghebreyesus stated, "But where science is drowned out by conspiracy theories, where solidarity is undermined by division, where sacrifice is substituted with self-interest, the virus thrives and the virus spreads. Globally, more than 64 million cases of COVID-19 have been recorded, with nearly 1.5 million deaths." World Health Organization's Director of Emergencies, Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking from Geneva, Switzerland, during the first dialogue, said, "Even with vaccines on the horizon, we're still in a very dangerous and difficult situation." Dr. Michael Ryan explained that some countries, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, are still experiencing major virus transmission. Although the situation in other regions may be stable, some of these countries still battle continued or returning transmission. Dr. Michael Ryan stressed, "We will be able to add vaccines to the current control measures, but let me be clear, vaccines or vaccination does not equal zero COVID." He added, "We must add vaccines to the existing parcel of measures that we have in place." As the United Nations Secretary General has remarked, the coronavirus pandemic has been the greatest challenge to the global community since the organization was founded 75 years ago. But according to David Beasley, Executive Director of the World Food Programme, WFP, it has also sparked international action that includes recovery plans and economic stimulus packages. However, David Beasley warned that next year is literally going to be catastrophic, as humanitarian needs double, with famine already knocking on the door of some 12 nations. He adds, as war drives hunger, fighting also must cease. Urging countries to step up, David Beasley said, "We can avert destabilization and famine and migration, but we've got to be out there sooner rather than later." He noted, "If we're strategic and put the funds of those particular icebergs before us, I believe that we can get through 2021 whilst we work with the vaccines and rebuild the economies so that we can have a better world and achieve zero hunger by 2030. The zero hunger target is among the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which all 193 United Nations member states adopted 5 years ago. The Sustainable Development Goals provide a blueprint for ending poverty, protecting the planet, and ensuring that all the peoples of this world live in peace and prosperity. Achim Steiner, administrator at the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, said, "The goals remain absolutely relevant because they are our compass for getting out of this crisis." Among the lessons that the United Nations Development Programme learned from the pandemic has been the importance of having good data, critical for targeting people in need, particularly in times of crisis, while issues relating to human rights and gender are now part of recovery plans. The administrator at the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, underlined the importance of the United Nations work in responding to the socio-economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, which has disproportionately affected women and the poor. According to a United Nations Development Programme-backed study issued recently, he warned that more than 1 billion people worldwide could be living in extreme poverty by the end of the decade if we do not manage to make the right choices now. He added, "But actually, the opposite is equally possible. This is the moment. It is a generational moment in which we need to think about the future of development in very different ways."
European News Bulletin.
Welcome, my name is Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from London. Now, tense news as a senior EU diplomat says the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier is rather downbeat about the prospects of sealing a new trade deal with Britain. This after a weekend of tense negotiations. Barnier briefed the bloc's national ambassadors in Brussels on Monday. He told envoys the EU and London were still not on the same page and that the ball is now firmly in the court of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Brexit sticking points have been whittled down to access to UK fishing waters and the so-called level playing field, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And as these negotiations go down to the wire behind closed doors, both Brussels and London must be mindful of public opinion on this ultimate game of brinkmanship. Well, as are we. So we took to the streets of the capital and got some reactions.
It's a pretty difficult position, to be honest. The negotiations have been going on for 4 and a bit years, so you'd hope that they got to a resolution, but at the end of the day, you want a good deal rather than a deal that would compromise our rights. And personally, I think the main area is services. We haven't done a good job enough for the city. We're focusing on fishing, which is a massive part of our GDP. We should be looking at other priorities. So not too happy that that's turned into a political statement rather than an actual business one.
Economically, for sure, it would be worse off to leave the EU in the short term, but it might be better in like the medium to long term. But that depends on what kind of deal they struck, or if there is no deal, then I think nobody knows what will happen.
Well, I think there's a lot of brinkmanship going on, and I guess something will magically resolve itself before the end of the year. What kind of deal that is, I don't know, but I think the French are being over demanding on the fish, so they might have to give way on that. The Germans want to sell us cars and wouldn't want tariffs, and yeah, we want to sell and trade in Europe, so there's probably a bit of give and take on both sides, I guess.
But I believe in God, and that whatever will be, it will work out okay, and we'll all be all right in the long run. So I'm relaxed about it, basically.
I think that they kind of need to extension, but they always leave until the last minute to rush these deals, and then they say they haven't got enough time. So I'd say they have an extension, but then are they just going to repeat the same thing again? Are we just going to have another few days left and then have to have another extension as well? So,
I mean, it can't go on for much longer because the European people, they're just getting more irritated and more irritated. I mean, now Macron is getting very vicious altogether, and I'm not English, but, you know, when you look back on what the English did for the French during two world wars, they saved them from annihilation, and yet the French can turn around and be very vicious when they feel like it. So get out now is my advice.
Yes, it sounds to me as though there's a certain amount of lack of goodwill on both sides, I suspect. I don't feel that everybody's making a huge effort necessarily, at least not from what's reported. I'd be slightly surprised if there were an extension. It feels like the British government would quite like to get out of there with no solution. That's what it feels like to me, anyway.
Some other news now, as more unrest in France as protests against police violence and a new draft security bill quickly disintegrated into clashes as police used tear gas and trenches in an attempt to disperse the crowds. The march began peacefully enough, with thousands of people waving banners and chanting slogans against the government and the police. However, violence soon erupted.
To see all the police present surrounding us is crazy. It's as if we're criminals. The government treats the protesters as criminals.
This means a lot to me. I was a victim of police violence in April last year. I took a hit from a truncheon by a riot policeman, which broke my neck. Since then, I've been scared of the police. I no longer trust them, and I will never trust them.
Weeks of protests have forced President Emmanuel Macron to take another look at his draft security law, which criminalizes the video recording of police. Macron also acknowledged that ethnic minorities were more likely to be stopped by police after footage emerged of officers assaulting a black music producer. Police unions have responded angrily to the president's comments. While Chris Denhond is in program, Macron has said he will take another look at this controversial security bill. But will this be enough?
Protesters, they demand, and because the actual, the current existing laws are more than sufficient to punish criminal behavior. So there is also a second problem for Macron. People inside his government, high government circles, they want to rewrite the law because they are not happy with the way that the French government is dealing with the security issue. And then there is a third element, inside the Senate, with a right-wing majority, they also want to rewrite this law. So it will take a while before this law will be applied, it will be put into practice, and in the meantime, it's very probable that the protests will go on.
Now, Macron is dealing with not just this situation, but accusations of Islamophobia. Tough times for the French president here, Chris.
Yes, well, he positioned himself, since he is president, in the center of the political spectrum. But, in fact, his political practice, he is looking to his right and even to his far right. So he is copying parts of the far-right party of Marine Le Pen concerning Muslims, concerning migrants, and concerning the way the security issue is dealt with. His problem is, the more he looks to his right, the more there is discontent on his left. So it's a dangerous situation for him, because when there were terrorist attacks, the public opinion, also under influence of the mass media, is going to the right and to the far right. But if he goes too much to the right, there is a real discount on the left, and people go, they take the streets, and when the lockdown is less severe and when demonstrations are authorized, which happens last weeks, people are on a massive way participating in demonstrations.
Now, on a final note, and very quickly for me here, Chris, he's got elections in April of 2022. This must worry him right now, the fact that he doesn't quite seem to be getting the balance right.
Well, he is really preparing his these elections. It's in less than a year, and the same thing. He is looking. The main danger for him is coming from the far right, Marine Le Pen, National Front Party, and on the left side, the progressive side, there are different candidates like Mélenchon. The Communist Party has a candidate. There will be other candidates. It's more divided. His main danger to be re-elected comes from the far right. That's why he's looking to the right at the moment.
All right, problems ahead there for the French president. Chris Denholm, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert, in Lachesh, 9,000 new Jewish homes in a Jerusalem area here in Al-Quds. I mean, this pace, total lie and a sham to any ideas of peace, surely.
Absolutely. The Zionist entity has just approved 9,000 settler units, and specifically a settlement which is located in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's called Atarot. Now, Atarot settlement will essentially isolate, once it's expanded with these 9,000 settler units, isolate Ramallah to the north of East Jerusalem from East Jerusalem itself. And it's part of this larger effort by the Zionist entity to attempt to cut off Jerusalem al-Quds from the Palestinian people and prevent it from being a Palestinian capital in the future. We know that under a two-state solution, the Palestinian capital is supposed to be based in Jerusalem al-Quds and East Jerusalem al-Quds. And the other settlements, of course, in that area, like Givat HaMatos and also Ramat Shlomo, are also being expanded. So it's part of an effort by Israel to specifically attempt to isolate Palestinians from East Jerusalem al-Quds. On top of that, right now, they're undergoing a large-scale ethnic cleansing program inside of East Jerusalem al-Quds, with a massive expulsion campaign going on. And whilst they're demolishing Palestinian homes, around 400 Palestinians have been made homeless just in East Jerusalem al-Quds this year alone, which is a phenomenal figure. This is really should be alarming. However, the international community is, it has failed time and time again to act. In fact, the statements coming out from them aren't even strong enough on these sort of things, let alone any sort of action coming about. So it just shows the international community is not in favor of actually delivering peace.
Indeed, and we have to remember, of course, that Netanyahu has elections, so this might be another pivot towards that.
Absolutely. This is something that Netanyahu, he will use to pander to his far-right base, and it's sort of projected that Netanyahu will go after trying to install a far-right religious government along with Naftali Bennett and his party, which, of course, if he's going to do that, he has to bring on the settler bloc. And this is, of course, 800,000 people, so there's a lot of people he's pandering to there.
Well, you know, it doesn't matter if Palestinian lives are at stake, if you can get your grubby hands on a few more votes. On to the social media reaction here, Robert.
The first one we've got here says, a two-state solution has been impossible for some time. Palestinians now need simple rule over their state. We have another one here as well commenting on this, who says, we can all thank the UAE for recognizing the fascist apartheid occupation to stop this happening. Oh, wait, never mind.
And we move from an occupation entity to, well, what's going on in Michigan there?
Well, another settler colonial project, of course, is having its far-right moments. Donald Trump's crowd seem to be riding on the wave that has been created of this culture war, and actually threatening the Secretary of State over, of course, what's going on to do with the voting system in Michigan. And we've seen that this is not just in one state. We've seen that armed Trump supporters around the country, belonging to a lot of white supremacist groups as well, have been threatening a lot of state officials, and have even attempted to kidnap state officials for what they see as a threat on their rights and liberties. And of course, Trump is fueling this all the way. He's still not accepting his defeat to Joe Biden. His supporters absolutely do not accept his defeat. Even though he hasn't accepted the defeat, he is accepting that he's not going to be inaugurated again. in January, as he is running a rally on that day, a pro-Trump rally he's going to be running on Inauguration Day, so it doesn't seem that he'll actually turn up there, as traditionally has been followed by presidents who lose their position or have completed their time in office. And Trump looks to be running, wanting to run in 2024, so it seems like this will go on for some time now.
Nothing's been traditional about this system, and perhaps just really shaken America's facade of democracy there, but your online reactions, the ones that you've scoped out, would be of interest to me.
The first we have here says, is this the well-regulated militia described in the 2A? I think not. More like a dangerous group of right-wing nuts emboldened with deadly weapons. We have another one here as well who says, Trump's behavior and rhetoric has emboldened his swamp to be criminally aggressive. This is not news, but things have heated up in Michigan. Trump needs to be held accountable for the actions that he encourages.
All right, Robert Inlakesh, obviously we'll continue to monitor the two stories you brought to our attention. Thank you. In some other news now, into Spain we go, because hundreds of far-right Vox supporters gathered in several major cities over the weekend to voice their contempt for the COVID-19 restrictions being imposed by the government. Speaking to local news outlets, protesters stated that, quote, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez had taken away their freedoms and destroyed the economy. Also attending the protest, Vox party leader Santiago Abascal said that the constitution was at risk as the COVID-19 restrictions were eroding the rights of citizens. Counter protests were blocked by police from congregating in the same area as Vox demonstrators to prevent clashes. 70 COVID-19 clinics have opened in the Russian capital just days after President Vladimir Putin ordered a large-scale immunization program. During a news conference, President Putin declared that the Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine will be made available to groups most at risk to the disaster, with the list including doctors, nurses, teachers, and social workers. Earlier last week, Russia's health minister, Mikhail Murashko, also announced that the country had already tested the vaccine on more than 100,000 of its citizens. So far, Russia has reported more than 2.4 million confirmed COVID-19 cases, the highest in Europe, with over 43,000 deaths. And of course, Ahmed Caballo back with us for social media, and this time we're talking Iranian tankers on their way, laden with oil, to Venezuela.
Yes, and this is apparently the largest fleet of oil tankers to date, and it defies the US ban. Now, this is again another example of Venezuela and Iran's cooperation, and both countries have many similarities. Both are anti-imperialist countries, both are countries with huge, large oil reserves that the US wants to get its hands on. But what's interesting about these countries, in many ways, is in their own region, there are many US client states that are hostile to them both. So in Iran, we have client states like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, that are trying to attack and undermine Islamic Republic. And in Latin America, you have states like Colombia, Brazil, Chile, who are again working within the US interests and trying to undermine the Bolivarian revolution there. So what they've done is they look for alliances not only in their region, but they've looked further abroad and they've found some sort of cooperation, and they're willing to support each other because they're in the same boat. Elliot Abrams is the US special representative for Venezuela and Iran, and he wants to overthrow and implement regime change in both of their countries. Now, Anya from the Gray Zone is actually in Venezuela at the moment, and she says this: the US-led economic war against Venezuela has brought Caracas and Tehran closer together. Iran broke the blockade against Venezuela this year, delivering much needed crude and even opening a grocery store in the country. I found this mural in central Caracas. Not everyone agrees. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's equally as hostile to Iran as he is to Venezuela, says this: Venezuela used to be a prosperous country. Under Maduro's corrupt and incompetent rule, The people of Venezuela are suffering. The US is helping the Venezuelan people in tangible ways, and we support a return to democracy through free and fair elections.
All right, now let me just intervene for a second there, Ahmed, because this strikes me that the, perhaps I can be so bold as to call him the outgoing Secretary of State here, he makes this statement without a hint of irony. Is it not America that's backed the last destabilizing events to try and topple the legitimately elected government in Venezuela, Ahmed?
Yeah, in the last 18 months, they've sponsored three coup attempts that have failed miserably. Now, the suffering that he talks about in Venezuela are the result of US sanctions. The Center for Economic Policy and Research, a Washington, D.C. based think tank that says US sanctions have killed 40,000 people in Venezuela in 2017 alone, and the sanctions have intensified since then, so only God knows what the real figure is at this moment in time. So it's a bit rich to say that, and it leads us on to our next story, actually, because on December the 6th, there have been elections in Venezuela for the National Assembly. Now, the indications show that the PSUV coalition has won that with 80% of the votes counted, showing that they've got 67% of the vote. Yet the mainstream media, who seem to be acting in cahoots with the US State Department and the British Foreign Office, are very much trying to delegitimize the results. So this article from ABC says, Venezuela's Maduro claims sweep of boycotted election. What they fail to acknowledge is that Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, was polling at 3%. Now, when Venezuelans polled, asked him if they believed he told the truth, only 4% said they did, that they believed him.
Ouch.
So it shows that, yes, they boycotted the election, but they boycotted the election because it showed that they had no chance of winning. And if they were to participate in an election in which they were to lose by a substantial figure, it would only strengthen Nicolas Maduro's position. So what they chose to do was boycott an election, which they knew they couldn't win. Now, you've got this tweet from Venezuela Analysis, a fantastic source for anything regarding Venezuela. They say, BBC reporter just said, results are a foregone conclusion because only government candidates are running. The State Department wouldn't have said it any better. 14,000 candidates, 100-plus parties, most of them opposition, are running. The BBC's low standards are the only foregone conclusion. Now, this election is very important because the National Assembly in Venezuela is, by its constitution, it needs to rectify international trades and international treaties. And what the opposition-led National Assembly were doing previously was they were boycotting and refusing to pass any legislation and supporting sanctions against their own country, hence why they were so unpopular within the country.
Final tweet, Ahmed?
Final tweet from Kenneth Roth. He's from the Director of Human Rights Watch. He says, Venezuela's election Sunday is a theatre piece meant to lend a veneer of legitimacy to the government of President Nicolas Maduro, who spent the last 7 years jailing opposition opponents, tearing apart opposition parties, and using extrajudicial killings and to stifle dissent. Now, obviously, he says that without a hint of irony.
Indeed.
Because Juan Guaido has tried many coups, and he walks around freely.
All right, we'll leave it there. Ahmed Caballo, thank you. We'll keep an eye on that one. And, of course, thank you. Take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Fear and sorrow are two grave maladies for every nation, every crowd, and every individual. Fear and grief are two grave pests, but they can be eliminated with this Quranic announcement. Also, if we show resistance, they will be eliminated as well. This is based on Quranic ayah as well, in case of those who say our Lord is Allah and further stand straight and steadfast, the angels descend on them. Fear you not, nor grieve. Holy Quran, chapter 41, verse 30. Resistance has the same impact. If you want to be free of fear and sorrow, you should place resistance and steadfastness at the top of your agenda. If you do so, you will have neither fear nor sorrow. These are based on Quranic statements.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, I should say that we have not properly carried out our duty in the area of the sacred defense. Of course, the tasks that our dear Sardar, the Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, mentioned are very good and valuable tasks. Nonetheless, they are few. We need more endeavors. Notice that the more we drift away from the sacred defense era, the closer we should get to it, ideologically speaking. Why is that? This is because distortion is lying in ambush. The hands of distortion are waiting in ambush. Well, you men of war live today, and you can say something to defend, but in 20 years, many of the participants today will not be there. In 30 years, more will be gone. The hand of distortion might distort this brilliant part of our history. Therefore, we should work. We should increase our knowledge and information. The sacred defense literature should be reinforced. The sacred defense literature is not a literary genre like other literary genres. It is not the case that we have epic, romantic, social, and even police literature, and therefore we can have the sacred defense literature as well. The sacred defense itself is a reservoir. Therefore, all kinds of literature can exist in it, and we can benefit from it.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
around the world with reporters.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit lockdowns, and not more funding for healthcare is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community. Then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel, or for that matter USA, would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter how the immigrants, might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli, or for that matter American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools